Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your ghost Tumblr and Finsta of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Yeah, I came in with a saw. Ooh, yeah, I came in with a saw. Yeah, yeah, cause I flare it raw. Yeah, bitch, dude, I flare it raw. Yeah, yeah, I came in with a saw. Ooh, yeah, I came in with a saw. Ooh, yeah, cause I flare it raw. Yeah, bitch, dude, I flare it raw. Yeah, walk in the trap like a boss. Ooh, walk in the trap like a boss. Walk in the trap like a boss. Walking and try like a boss. Trap. Yeah, I came in with a sauce. Ooh. Yeah, I came in with a saw. Ooh. Yeah, I chop flare red raw. Ooh. If chop flare red raw. Ooh. Walking and try red flare. I'm also still working on the SoundCloud thing. Here we are, weeks later, and I'm still working on the SoundCloud thing. That was Lil Pump. I just feel like we just want to hear a little Pump when we're going to talk about how big corporations are not punk and don't care about your artistic output. So we have to start with Lil Pump. That was Boss. Lil Pump would not exist without SoundCloud. And when I think how much is the career of Lil Pump worth, I wonder, is it worth the $160 odd million that was recently used to bail SoundCloud out? There's only one person on the planet I want to talk about these things with, and that's Jenna Wortham. Hi, Jenna.
What up, John?
Jenna is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a co-host of Still Processing, and she's here for some bonus processing this week. There's a lot of processing.
I like that.
That's good. So, Jenny, you wrote a couple weeks ago in the magazine, you wrote a little bit about what's happening with SoundCloud. If you can set up, before we kind of get to the bigger questions, set up a little bit what the tension that was happening over with SoundCloud was.
That column was about what happens if a service like SoundCloud goes away? Not really worrying so much about the business practices of the company and what their financial management skills look like. I mean, they seem from the outside to be not great.
Sus.
Yeah, really. a little sus, yes. A little disorganized. But really, what does it mean when culture and internet culture and digital culture is tied to a business strategy and tied to a platform and tied to something that they don't control? The culture has no control over.
And two opposite forces at play. You have the creative force coming up from the bottom up, mm-hmm. of all these individuals who are sort of putting their hopes and their dreams and their creativity onto a platform, mm-hmm. whatever it is, SoundCloud, Vine, YouTube, whatever. And then you have a company who is basically trying to find craven ways of monetizing all of those individual little energies.
Yeah.
And so the concern with SoundCloud, it was announced or it was leaked that SoundCloud was about to run out of money, like imminently.
Yeah.
And Chance the Rapper gets on Twitter and he's like, I'm working on it.
Right.
I'm working
on it. I mean, that was also just like so great.
Just putting the cape on and swooping in.
I got it.
Got it.
Guys,
this. No problem.
Got this.
I solved the whole thing. All of tech. I solved it.
That's so
done.
Cool.
Done. You know, I got a three hat on and I'm ready over here to solve the problem. So that happens, and then I don't think Chance the Rapper personally gave $160 some odd million to SoundCloud.
No.
That'd be my guess.
No.
But the company did get a new round of investment.
They did, and it seemed like they raised it from a bunch of like financiers and bankers, not traditional venture money. And then part of the deal was the CEOs would step down and they would bring in people from Vimeo or other such internet companies who have figured out how to turn their creative capital into actual capital.
Right. Now, let's assume for a moment that a corporation like SoundCloud being able to monetize the energy that's captured on their products is a worthwhile thing. Let's just assume that. Mm-hmm. They had a premium service where they're charging people for access to certain kind of data. They're also having a premium service for users where you can skip ads and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. In theory, business models like that work. Spotify has a premium tier. Like, things like that are okay. Are you pro or con that kind of approach from a corporate perspective?
I'm neutral. Okay. I'm neutral. I don't know how people make money off of anything on the internet. So if you can figure it out, I'm like, more power to you. Mm-hmm. I think the chorus, when the news that SoundCloud was running out of money, became, well, how much do we need to pay to support this service? But I think also the threshold that most people have in terms of what they're willing to pay for something, like Netflix sets the sort of lowest common denominator mm-hmm. because what is it, like $7 a month and you get thousands of right. TV shows, hundreds of movies, like new stuff all the time. I think anything above that price point is hard for people to wrap their minds around.
Sure.
And frankly, SoundCloud can't even make $8 a month work, and it has all the record companies, all the money, all the things in its pocket. So I think there is a sense of what it might take for people to be able to support SoundCloud and what's realistic in terms of what they would actually have to pay. If it's like $25 a month, are people going to pay for that? I don't know. I think subscription services work to a degree, but I think that anyone trying to do that has to be really realistic about how many people actually pay for those services.
As a total sidebar, do you think micropayments for something like this is a complete non-thing?
You know, I've been actually really surprised by how many people have made GoFundMes and Patreons work in the last couple of weeks. Mm. I feel like there's been like a lot of people just throw out links on Facebook or on Twitter or Instagram. Like, here's my Venmo. Here's my PayPal if mm-hmm. you want to donate. And I think people do give money.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's a sustainable business model. And I think SoundCloud's problem is they've already raised a lot of money from people who are waiting for a return on that investment. If they were kind of an indie, if it was Bandcamp, for example, right. I don't know what Bandcamp's VC sheet looks like, if they've mm-hmm. even taken money or if they've
I'm not sure.
It's probably like a small amount, but mm-hmm. that's one where micropayments might work because their bottom line is probably low enough where they don't need a tremendous coffer of money to keep running. But SoundCloud's biggest expenses has to be just hosting and the storage. Like, I mean, I just don't know how much that cost, but it has to be the majority of their money is being eaten up by hosting costs.
As a user, as a creative person, when you're engaging with a service like YouTube or SoundCloud, those costs are not passed on to you. Am I correct about that?
Well, the difference between a service like YouTube and SoundCloud is that YouTube's owned by Google, and Google has infinite resources, including their own hosting services, so they can eat that cost mm-hmm. or, you know, they can figure out how to make it make sense for them. Because ultimately, YouTube is still part of Google's advertising business, and Google has all these products.
So there are other ways to monetize
advertising.
Right. It's a loss leader in a sense. It's like we'll trade the storage space, we'll trade that server space in the upfront in exchange for whatever we know, whatever percent of the advertising revenue we're going
to
get.
Yeah, because they are, I mean, everything Google does is to basically run ads next to it.
Right.
Like, their primary business is online advertising. Mm-hmm. It's not any of the other products they roll out. Those are just to get more like ad territory.
Right.
And SoundCloud never, I mean, they operated almost reversely. It was more like, let's just start this thing and see what happens. And then how do we make money off of it? And right. I think music, right, it has to be one of the trickiest ways to make money online, like a streaming music service. Mm-hmm. It's like near impossible.
I think we have to introduce the idea of who's using these services.
Like
when I look at SoundCloud, you
kids.
Know, I see kids, 16-year-old,
cuties.
You know, people who think Lil Pump is old.
Yeah,
you know,
little babies.
I see a lot of young people. I see a lot of kids of color.
Mm-hmm.
I see people who don't have access to the traditional record label system mm-hmm. or who aren't going to get signed, but they will create a little ecosystem that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's nothing when you sign up for SoundCloud that says, well, maybe there is. There's probably fine print that's basically like, we could shut this down at any time. Like, this could disappear.
It's that's always like, implicit, though. That's always implicit, but we forget. Like, we get so dependent on the services that we use, we forget that they aren't free and that they aren't infinite.
Right. Do you think generationally, do you think the average 16 to 19-year-old understands that?
I wonder. I think there is a little bit of savviness to it, yes. But I also think we take so much of the software we use for granted mm-hmm. that we forget that it's not just a utility, that it's not just a given.
Like water.
or electricity. Like you turn the light switch, the lights
Flint.
Come on. Except for Flint. I know.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, in other places, we don't even know about
right.
real talk. But yeah, we take it for granted that we have access to stuff. And I think software has become part of that too.
I sometimes wonder if I'm a 16-year-old and I'm uploading something to SoundCloud, like, am I keeping backup files? Like,
yeah.
I personally, like, I'm, when I come to my music library, for example, like, things I've just collected over the years, like, I've always been very uptight about having, like, here's a backup.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, like, a hard copy, and then if I digital copy, and then, like, a separate hard drive, mm-hmm. or maybe there's just another copy of it stored.
That's you, though. No one else is doing that.
Right. Okay, so that's fair,
that's
right?
That's just you.
Totally fair if that's just me. So I have been wondering, and part of the reason I've been wondering is because Tumblr just deleted my Tumblr, not just, but like recently deleted my Tumblr from the internet.
Really? Did they give you a notification?
Maybe.
They were like, it's been inactive or?
Inactive.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, Tumblr got whacked. Sorry.
Yeah.
But Tumblr got whacked.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, we're not looking at it. So.
Right. But like, I went to go look at it one day and it was like some weird, I think it was like in Polish or something. It was like someone had just like taken the name.
Whoa.
So Tumblr, just FYI, if you're listening, give me my archives. But it just, you just realize like these things can be basically ripped away from you.
Yeah.
And if I like am generally like a pretty observant, like mark my deadlines type person,
mm-hmm.
if it can happen to me, it certainly can happen to like any number of other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is where I started thinking about the big questions of kind of ethical responsibilities.
Yeah.
About, you know, if you upload all your things to YouTube, does YouTube have some kind of abstract ethical responsibility to have an archive saved for you should something go wrong? Does SoundCloud have the responsibility? Is this something that's come up in the space, whether with those companies or other companies that do similar things?
I think the question of ethical conduct and ethical obligations is always implicit, and you know, it's always a thing that comes up when we think about how much of our lives and how much information and how much content really we give these services, and that's their lifeblood. They need that to keep going. But I think there's a very cynical way to look at it, which is like they don't really care. They're not thinking about it and they're not worried about it. And I think if anything, they're getting a lot more liberal with what they feel they can do with that information. I mean, there used to be a clause in the Facebook terms of services that were like, well, if we want to use any of your photos for advertising, we can. And people like freaked out and they walked it back. I mean, there's always sort of this sense of this is my personal archive that I'm making on your service. And that's how we think about it as the consumers
right.
and the users. But the companies are like, you're getting this for free. We'll do whatever
using,
we want.
You're using our service.
Yeah,
like
we'll do whatever we want with it. And mm-hmm. so I think that maybe there's been a little bit more of an awakening of realizing that there is a cynicism and these companies are just completely business-minded. They're not community-minded. I mean, the community to them is the byproduct. It's like that is the thing that keeps them in business and they're grateful for it, but mm-hmm. they're not obligated, I don't think, in any way. And they don't see themselves as obligated. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't be.
And again, not all these services operate in the same way.
Because
as YouTube, for example, will pay people to make content,
mm-hmm.
then it's up on YouTube. And theoretically, like I know people who make content for YouTube, they have a point person or whatever,
mm-hmm.
like someone
mm-hmm.
they could, if there's a grievance, they can raise a grievance with that person or with a department.
Same with like Instagram and like, yeah.
Sure. But like SoundCloud, certainly best I can tell,
yeah,
did not have anybody, or at least had very, you know, from when I was doing my research for my reporting for my mm-hmm. SoundCloud rap story, almost everybody I spoke to was basically like, no one at SoundCloud knows what's up. Like they're not,
yeah.
they're not sort of like engaged in the project that we're engaged in.
Part of that, I wonder maybe if that comes from a lack of understanding about what type of culture would be built around music communities.
Because mm-hmm.
I think on Tumblr, for example, like they had a person who was liaison for a long time between Tumblr people and book publishers. Like they would be like, oh, this Tumblr could be a short form book and like
right.
maybe we'll help you with this person. There's a lot more, you know, Instagram's an example of they have people who work with the fashion community because they're like, we understand this is its own culture and you have your own needs and this is a very implicit or there's a very unique set of things that people who are using this for food porn needs. So we'll assign a person to that. And I don't know that SoundCloud ever really understood beyond them trying to figure out A, how to make money off of it, not anger the creators and the users so much that they would leave. But I don't think they were ever like, should we be thinking about a concert series? Should we be looking
right.
for people who are like weird subgenres that are bubbling up? Should
right.
we be looking at SoundCloud rap? Should we be doing this? I don't know that how much they were thinking about the different niche communities that were being built out on SoundCloud, whereas a lot of other social media services have been actively thinking about that since day one.
Let's listen to the type of song that people at SoundCloud probably didn't know what to do with. Let's listen to Audi by Smoke Purp.
I don't want friends, I want Audis. Smoking on booth in his Maui. I check that bitch like I'm Mari. Sorry, bitch, I don't say sorry. Look at my cup, it got dope. I bend her over like slow. Picking her mouth, did she choke? Couple of bands in my mouth. Couple of bands in the south. I pay the bands in the west. Then take the bands to the south. Look at my watch, that's a 50. Went in New York for like 50. I think it be one to kiss it. I let her tell me no kiss it.
We'll be back in a sec.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
So, okay, here's another thing, though, right? If no one at SoundCloud is doing any kind of proactive, say, policing or judgment of content, you will end up with some genres that are forming up or some content that's forming up that maybe you don't know how to attach yourself to. Mm-hmm. SoundCloud Rap's a very interesting example where you have quite a few problematic faves working in that space. Mm-hmm. You have XXXTentacion, who has these sort of very ugly criminal charges looming over him, but is also one of the most popular people on that platform. And if you're a sort of theoretically a content agnostic company like SoundCloud, and then you look, you cover your eyes, and then one day you open them, you're like, oh my God,
yeah,
this is what's on our platform. Maybe the reason nobody knew is nobody wanted to know.
Right. Yeah.
And it's sort of the opposite of YouTube, which has been lately like demonetizing a lot of videos, and there are a lot of creators who, you know, used to have like a decent living, but now like 70% of that's been like yanked out from under them because mm-hmm. YouTube has been overly solicitous of advertisers and advertisers' needs and therefore policing the content. SoundCloud seemed to be in the opposite place just like, we're going to let it be a free-for-all, and once we find out what it is, not it.
Yeah.
To what degree is this sort of gap between the needs of the company and the needs of the users, how much of that comes down to fundamental demographics? The type of people who work in tech and who are executing these programs are not 16-year-old black kids who want to make great vines.
Right. That was sad. Oh, man. Just all the Vine content that was lost. This is so sad.
Is it not? And is it 100% lost, or is it like,
I think it's around,
like in some like liminal space somewhere?
I mean, yeah, it's in some weird purgatory, I'm sure. But I think just thinking through what tends to happen when these sites and these services go away, they say for a little while that they're going to keep the archives, they're going to be around, but usually people forget and it goes away and it gets disappeared at some point. It gets whisked away and like stuffed into like a cold storage room somewhere. Right. And that's just the end of it. But I think for me, I'm not so, like, I don't mourn the loss for my personal benefit. I mourn the loss for future generations, sure, for like academics, for, I don't know, like researchers, for digital archivists to be able to just, what were people thinking about in this period of time? Mm-hmm. It's like, those are our diaries, you know, like mm-hmm. those are the things. Like, I remember going to the Basquiat exhibit and the Keith Haring exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum a few summers ago. And both had tremendous amounts of resources of scribblings and drawings and notes and exchanges. All that's digital now, right? Like, if you're going to show that at some point in the future, like 50
it's
years from
notes
now.
Notes mode, it's voice memos.
Yeah. That's going to be stuff on a screen.
Yeah, of course.
So just to think of that not being around and we don't have that to access to, and there are no future curators who are like, mm-hmm. this was actually like a very important, you know, comedic coping mechanism for teens who mm-hmm. are thinking about living under Trump, you know, mm-hmm. and that'll just be gone.
Am I mistaken in remembering that in early Twitter, there was an announcement that the Library of Congress was going to archive all of Twitter. Is that real?
Yeah, but I've heard it's a mess. I've heard that they don't know how to store it. How do you search it? I mean, if you've ever exported your, I've exported my own archive from Twitter a few times. Searching it is really difficult. I mean, I've done that with my text messages. Where I've exported my text messages from old phones, and then it's just like in an Excel sheet.
Right.
It's useless if it's not contextualized. I'm glad that they're trying to save it. Maybe somebody will figure out, there'll be like a Indiana Jones of the future that can like figure out how to decode it and do all the right things with it. But I think there's just so much material that we're trying to save. And I think even if someone tried to export all the stuff from SoundCloud and save it, it's still like, it's like terabytes of data. It's so much. It's a huge amount.
But is that not the moral choice?
We should be doing it. But I also think like a best case scenario would be like an Amazon or somebody who has a web hosting service would just donate a portion of their servers that are negligible to them. And just to be like, this is our nonprofit thing that we're doing.
Yeah. Like sort of the Google Books project that was going to scan, that sort of got held up in the courts ultimately, but that was going to scan all the books that were like older than 75 years old, any books
just
that was
to
out
like
of copyright.
Keep
just
them.
Yeah. It's just that anyone can access them. So something along those lines.
Google's probably not going to go away in our lifetime, but we're still dependent on, for the most part, private institutions to keep public memory. Like we have museums and libraries that are state funded, state sponsored, because we rely on them. I mean, they're not neutral, but we rely on them to be beyond business and commercial interests. And it's really risky when you're expecting a company like Facebook and Google to care about a public record.
Right. But, and again, it's like, so I ask if it's a moral question, and then I wonder, like, should it be sort of legislated in some way? Like, should there be, if you're going to be a service like that, that that's part of the terms of service or incorporation documents.
That'd be great, but I just feel like Silicon Valley is so powerful in Washington, like way more powerful than we realize, that they would, it would be very difficult to get them to do anything they didn't want to do.
And like who's lobbying?
Who's lobbying for that? Yeah.
And this is where we sort of get into the other part of the conversation, which is who's lobbying for kids? Who's lobbying for Black communities?
Who's taking them seriously enough?
Yeah. And so when I think of SoundCloud going away, which it doesn't seem like it is, thankfully, when I think of that, I
wonder.
6 months from now, a year from now, you never know. But when I think of that going away, I think of Black history being gone. When
Definitely.
I think of Vine going away, I think of Black history being gone. And that's agonizing.
Yeah.
And so how come the public conversation outside of a few people isn't really focused on that? I feel like so much of it is focused on, can Spotify save SoundCloud, and not SoundCloud is sort of this collective memory site that we should all like be invested in preserving. How come the conversation is not tipped in that direction?
That's a good question. I mean, we're not used to thinking about any of these repositories as sites of cultural memory. I think we understand that they're sites of cultural activity and sites of cultural gatherings, but I don't think we're able to, you know, necessarily put the present in the context of the past and understand that that's why this is important. And I think, I mean, even when we talk about why Twitter is useful, it's like we're tapping into the pulse. It's not like we're building this archive, you know, that's not really what the conversation looks like. But I have been really encouraged to find out that there are a lot of librarians, there are a lot of digital archivists, there are a lot of, you know, basically digital book nerds who are really interested in preserving, and they're really interested in trying to understand how social movements are being categorized and cataloged and captured online and not just happening online. I think our reaction is to sort of tap in and sort of see what's happening in the moment. I do think there's a pretty interesting growing group of librarians, technologists, software designers who are thinking about this stuff.
Are they actively working on technological solutions?
Yeah, they have meetups and things. I've seen like there was an annual gathering of like American librarians or something, and there's apparently like a very strong digital leg of programming in that's like dedicated entirely to thinking about social communities online and what do we do about them.
In the way that the Internet Archive sort of scrapes the internet and kind of saves web pages, are there equivalent tools for?
Yes.
I mean, look, I know there are like SoundCloud rippers and YouTube rippers, things like that, but it's one page at a time. Are there tools like that that can be applied on a broader scale?
I think so. I mean, I think, again, it's like the sheer cost of hosting that data and just preserving it and updating it and making sure that things are all still compatible for searching is the tricky part. But I know that there are a few people who are like actively working against this stuff. And even archive.org, like they seem great, but I don't know who's running it. I don't know that they're prioritizing the things that they're prioritizing. I mean, they may not have a diverse staff that can say, right, like, oh, the reason Vine is interesting is because it is Black cultural creative production. You know, they may just be like, oh, well, we have to keep Vine. I mean, who knows, right, what they're looking at. Maybe they're taking everything. But I think that's also a question of who decides what, right, is history and who decides what's worth preserving.
And is there, coming from the other direction, instead of from a corporation or an institution down, mm-hmm, are there any movements? Because I haven't seen anything, at least not on the music side, but are there any movements from the creator side that say, yeah, we're going to give SoundCloud our music, or yeah, we're going to put things on Vine or YouTube, but we're also going to preserve things in some other way?
I wonder.
That you've come across?
I haven't. Yeah. And I don't think the creators are thinking about it like that. I think that we're very much in a hyper-productive and hyper-consumptive state of being. I would hope, right? Like, a music creator has other copies of their songs that they're posting, right, onto SoundCloud. But so much of what makes these musical experiences interesting is what happens after they go online. It's like the other types of songs they inspire, the way people comment on them, like, mm-hmm, how things get passed around. Like, what's hard to capture, right?
It's
like thinking about an artist like Lil Pump. It's like not just about the music that they're making, but, yes, it's how that music is in conversation with other types of, mm-hmm, artists and other, you know, it's like, who's, mm-hmm, documenting that? Like, who's looking at that? Because we have art historians and we have curators. We have people who are observing and are able to put a piece of artwork or a piece of content into context of other pieces that are made and that are dialogical. Mm-hmm. So you understand more about what was happening. And I don't know if there's like a SoundCloud historian or a SoundCloud curator.
I have no idea. No, I mean, someone should get on that, yeah, like immediately. But also the other thing that I was worrying about was, I mean, I think it's something that you've written about in previous columns and in other sort of pieces about the ephemerality of digital culture, mm-hmm, that being almost in a sense integral,
yeah,
to a lot of what's happening on the internet. And I wonder, how different is it to say post something to Snapchat that you know is going to go away, or to post something on Vine that maybe you don't own the rights to, or, mm-hmm, you won't have the rights to 12 months down the line or 2 years down, mm-hmm, the line? Is that different, especially to a younger person? Is that actually different?
That's a good question. I mean, there is, to a degree, always going to be an element of ephemerality to the way the internet works and the way the things we post on the internet live. And that is part of the appeal, that they don't last forever necessarily, whether by design, mm-hmm, or just by typical lifespan of, yeah, like internet company.
Fate, circumstance.
The internet startup boneyard is, mm-hmm, littered with 1,000 skulls. But I also think Vine is different in a way because it was so much about how people were interacting with each other.
So intertextual.
On it. Yeah. So interconnected.
Yeah.
It was so interconnected.
Yeah.
And no matter what happens now, I just feel like that's lost. Even if they are able to save it, it's just not.
Right. You can't recreate the network.
Yeah.
You might be able to save the video.
Right.
You might be able to even save the comments.
Right.
But you can't recreate the network. You can't recreate what someone's feed looked like.
And the moment, too. Because, yeah, a lot of stuff on Vine was a person doing something accidental that became a meme, and then you would, mm-hmm, have like 100 people doing the exact same restaging the exact same thing, and then that became commentary on just how people were looking at each other and interacting with, mm-hmm, each other. And I think that's harder to recapture and harder to remember.
I guess the last question is then, on some level, do we have to accept that the archival impulse that maybe people like you and I feel, people we know who work in museums, people we know who work in institutions, that we feel and in many ways we're raised with, is just something that's going to be lost in a later generation because it was never actually available to those folks?
I don't think so, actually. I've been really encouraged by the offline, like, zine and art movement that, mm-hmm, I feel is emerging. And, yeah, I think especially watching, and they're not even that young. I mean, you know, one of my favorite zine makers is in his 30s. And I think there is a desire to create things that last. I think there is a desire to make things that can be passed around and commented on in person. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a desire for alternatives to what feels like a never-ending tide of shifting, disappearing items and emotions and feelings and thoughts and objects of art. So I think there'll always be a dialogue and there'll always be a conversation and there will always be a tension between real and not real, digital and physical, ephemeral and lasting. Like, I think that all this stuff kind of operates in tandem. I'm an eternal optimist, though. Like, I, mm-hmm, feel like culture is evolving for the better because we have the internet. And I think part of what we're seeing happen, too, is an active push away from the internet sometimes and, mm, the way that creativity has become so platform specific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's a, yeah, way to be funny on Instagram that's very different from a way to be funny on Twitter that's very different from a way to be funny on, mm-hmm, Facebook. And you see people experiment within those various mediums, but I also think there's a desire to get beyond that too. That is encouraging to me.
It's interesting because I think a parallel idea to the thing that you're talking about is, like, for so long with music, it was like, well, we're going to get the universal jukebox finally. Mm-hmm. Like, everything that's ever been recorded will all be accessible. Nothing will be out of print.
Right.
And what the internet has actually created are the circumstances for new ways to go out of print, new ways to disappear.
Definitely.
And I've been struck in my side of the world with cassette culture.
Cool.
All these things that are, we're going to give you a tactile product that you actually can't put in your computer.
Cool.
You can't put near your computer. It's going to be a physical object. Uh-huh. And that's sort of the musical equivalent of kind of what you're talking about, where it's like, we understand the internet is powerful, and sure, we'll put up a SoundCloud link to whatever, but more importantly, we've created a physical object.
Cool.
And so that means I can't throw out my cassette player, but it also means that, like, I will have this for time immemorial,
right,
which I
right.
may not have if I lose the link or right. if my hard drive collapses.
Exactly.
One of my many hard drives.
Yeah.
I think that's what's happening, and that strikes me as the closest I've seen to kind of an archival impulse, even if it is this kind of, like, micro-level mm-hmm. archival impulse. Mm-hmm. It's not someone being like, I scraped SoundCloud and saved it. It's more like, well, I did my part. I have this small note.
Right.
Music, and it's here in your hand.
And ultimately, listening to you talk makes me realize that once these companies figure out how much people do want to archive, if they will, they'll definitely make it possible because they can charge us so much money for yes. Dropbox subscriptions, iCloud subscriptions, Google Drive. I mean, that's like secondary business to them. So, of course, this eventually they'll catch up to our needs if enough people have those same needs. So it'll come. And all these things, too, are evolving in tandem, too. I think the desire for more tangible offline culture and then the more interest in preserving ephemeral day-to-day internet right. culture.
So if anyone's working in these services and they're listening, you have a moral imperative. But if that doesn't help, you can probably make some money off of it.
Get the dollar bills. They're coming your way.
Heavy fucking
stuff. I spend so much money on storage. I was just thinking about it. Like, so much money on cloud storage. It's insane.
Yeah.
So, it's crazy.
So why not some more?
Yeah.
All right, let's go out with one more song that hopefully will not be lost in the great SoundCloud purge of 2020. Let's listen to Love Scars by Trippie Redd. Hey. That is this week's podcast. Thank you to Jenna Wortham.
My pleasure.
Not as much as mine. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can do that at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. You can email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Last week, we asked if you guys wanted an all Ashley Simpson podcast, and the response was overwhelming. Keep those emails coming, but we're going to have a good surprise for you coming later in the fall. Every podcast ever is archived. Hopefully.
Right. Let's hope.
Oh, my God. Now I have like agita about it. NYTimes.com/podcast, at least for now. Our producers are Mike Cordero and Pedro Rosado, and we will be back next week. Girl, you got me going out back. Girl, you got me real sad. Devil, baby.